This is Orson Welles. And this, I'm sorry to say, is the next to the last broadcast on a series of Sunday commentaries I've been sending out in your direction over the ABC network for just about a year now. It's been hard work. I've learned a lot in the course of knocking these shows together week after week. I think I've gained a few friends, and I'm sure I've made a lot of new enemies. I'm being sued for $2 million, and I've been burned and hanged in effigy because of things I've said on this program. I'd like to thank ABC for the chance they've given me to say those things, and I'd like to say that if I ever get the chance to say those things again, I'll say them again. I've been talking to a microphone for quite a spell now in one capacity or another, but in all the years since I've started, though I've had ratings much higher, I've never had such wonderful letters from people who listen in. Nor so many letters. That means a lot. I'd like to thank you for them. And there have been other things that have cheered me up occasionally about the job or maybe given me the feeling that I wasn't wasting your time altogether. Most recently, there was the case of Isaac Woodward. By now, it's a pretty famous case. Well, it was this broadcast that brought it first to your attention. Woodward, of course, was the Negro soldier who was blinded by the policeman. First, we called the policeman Officer X. But finally, just as we promised Officer X, our investigators dug him out of anonymity. His name is Shull. And we told Mr. Shull we'd never let him be. Well, we won't. We told Mr. Shull on this program that we'd see him brought to justice. Well, we have. I'm quite shamelessly proud of the wire I'm going to read you now. It comes from the head of the NCAAP. Congratulations. As a result of your persistent focusing of public spotlight on Stormtrooper Shull, the United States Department of Justice finally cracked down. Shull was yesterday made a target of criminal charge by the Department of Justice for violating federal civil rights statute, which prohibits police from depriving a person of rights secured by the Constitution and the laws of the U.S. This, as you know, is seldom used statute passed by Congress in 1870 to implement the 14th Amendment giving civil rights to Negroes. This action of the Justice Department is an historic move with profound implications. You are responsible. Please accept deep gratitude of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People's 700,000 members. Yours sincerely, signed Walter White. Yes, I'm very proud of that. Well, some of you were quite disturbed by our stand on the current Henry Wallace controversy. Some of you were pleased. Others wrote for clarification. With these last few minutes left me to broadcast commentary, I'd like to try to sum up what I've been saying lately about foreign policy. I hate war. One of our great presidents spoke for the whole family of man, spoke for the first righteous instincts of every hearth in every law-abiding nation when he spoke that simple sentence. I hate war. It's nothing for me to add that I agree with Franklin Roosevelt. Every mother's son hates war. Every son's mother hates war. But the millionaire press must be answered. Franklin Roosevelt's friend, Henry Wallace, has been called a kind of traitor and a kind of fool. The fact is that Henry Wallace is an honest man and he's nobody's fool. With much of what he's had to say in recent weeks regarding our country's conduct in foreign affairs, I take the sharpest possible exception. I don't hold with theories of the inviolability of spheres of influence. I don't hold with spheres of influence, period. I don't think any national interest, however benevolent, merits any special preserves. I want the wide world to live to be a sphere of influence for the triumphant principle of democracy. Sure, I know the big fishes eat all the little fishes in the sea, but I refuse to embrace the international morality of dog eat dog. Sure, people are selfish and greedy, sure. But there wouldn't even be words for selfishness and greed in any language if there wasn't such a thing as sacrifice and generosity in every language. Let's face the global facts of life, but for the love of heaven, let's not throw down our weapons and surrender because we don't like the view. From where we stand today, the scenery isn't very pretty. Vistas of garbage rise between us and the wild blue yonder. On the most hopeful promontories are strewn waste and heedless litter where the foreign ministers have held their picnics. Up from the darkened valleys floats the reek of unmade graves. Blasted cities hum with the industry of rats. The abundance of the earth rots and festers in the sunlight. If you stop to listen, you can hear the crying of a frightened child. Sure, let's see things as they are, but for the love of man, let's not leave them that way. Sure, I believe in power, politics. I also believe in cancer. They both kill a lot of people. But that doesn't mean that people can't do something about it. I recognize that any strategy for peace must acknowledge the realities of power politics, but I deny that peace, any kind of peace, can be firmly founded in a world where the peacemakers cheerfully capitulate to naked force. The naked force isn't so dangerous. The capitulation is fatal. Henry Wallace spoke not only for the common man, but for the blessed cause of common sense when he pointed out in his own words that naked power is not exclusively a Russian argument. That naked power as a substitute for law and logic is by no means held in monopoly by the Soviet Union. Naked power is a division of the Red Army, sure. Naked power is a division of the British Army. Armies are naked power, and battleships and atom bombs are naked power. Henry Wallace did well when he stood up and with such noble tactlessness said right out loud that no single nation is the enemy of the United Nations. But he did badly, I think, when he added in his own words that we ought to behave ourselves and stay in our own backyard. Of course we ought to behave ourselves. We mustn't drop atom bombs on our neighbors just to keep them from making some atom bombs of their own. We shouldn't threaten such things, and even if we don't mean it, we shouldn't talk as though we do. But why should we stay in our own backyard? That sounds too much like a nasty thing called isolationism. If it isn't a new way of saying America first, I'm afraid at best it's another formula for non-intervention. And of all the echoing phrases in all the double talk of diplomacy, non-intervention is one of the emptiest. There's no such animal. If you see a man knock down a woman and you don't knock down the man, you probably tell yourself you're practicing the policy of non-intervention, but of course you're doing no such thing. By failing to intervene in behalf of the woman, you are in fact intervening in behalf of the man. Personally, I've always been an interventionist, and I'll bet you're exactly the same thing yourself. From the first, I wanted to intervene against Hitler. I bet you did. I wanted to intervene against Franco and Mussolini and Perón. Such poor weapons as I have, I've used against those men. Two of them are still unvanquished, Perón and Franco, and whatever little strength is mine to be counted on the side of their enemies. We're the natural friends of freedom. Henry Wallace is on my side of that battle, the anti-fascist side, and in the showdown, he won't try to pretend that he's neutral. I deny absolutely that a conscious citizen can absent his judgment and sympathy from a question of right and wrong, regardless of where in the world the question may arise. A phony election in Greece or Bulgaria or Mississippi is a matter of concern in Sweden and Guatemala and New Zealand. The voice of our brother's blood crieth unto us from the ground, and the word is yes, yes, we are every man of us, our brother's keeper. Of course I hate war, and so do you, and so did Franklin Roosevelt. But war came, and our people discovered there were some things that we hated even more bitterly than we hated war. I love peace, and so do you, and so does everybody in the house next door to you. But since peace came, we've all of us discovered again that there are some things that we love even more passionately than we love peace. We're going to be careful not to confuse peace with pacifism. That wasn't one of Franklin Roosevelt's mistakes. Another wartime president, and one that has been noted for his pacifism, spoke with the full resonance of the democratic morality when he said, "The right is more precious than peace." It's less than nothing for me to tell you that I agree with Woodrow Wilson. Of course the right is more precious than peace. Progressives have been saying just that for a long time now, saying it about Spain and Ethiopia and Manchuria. It's not the progressives who will be mentioned in the records of this century as the champions of soft peace. Vichy wasn't our solution. Dalin wasn't our baby. Appeasement is the particular guilt of those who use the word against us now. Well, I'm using the word progressive, and I don't much like the word. Unhappily, I don't have a better word for what I mean. What do I mean? Well, you, who never once voted for Roosevelt, you who think Wallace is a downy-headed dreamer or a dangerous crank who hate a bestseller called One World, you who are delighted that I am going off the air, you will say that progressive is another word for red, that maybe it lets in lots of pinks, but that mainly speaking, a progressive is a stooge of Stalin's, involved, consciously or otherwise, in a world plot to overthrow the profit system, alias the American way, and to unseat our form of representative government. True enough, communists call themselves progressives, but don't forget there are Nazis who call themselves Americans, and that doesn't mean that Americans are Nazis. And you who are the average member of the Roosevelt majority, will say that a progressive is just somebody who believes in progress. An American progressive is an American who does not think that progress is un-American, who believes that the notion that people can make a better world for their children is not a foreignism, but proudly and particularly an American way of thought. Now, there are many, many things going on in Eastern Europe, for example, today that we progressives don't like one little bit. It should be noted, however, that our disapproval grows out of a tradition of moral criticism which is our heritage and which belongs to us. Our present critics here at home can lay no claim to that tradition. There are many, many things going on in India today that Russia doesn't like, and what's more interesting, that most Englishmen don't like. Many things are going on in Georgia and in South Carolina, which England doesn't like and Russia doesn't like, and we don't like either. Here's a disapproval in which the political opponents of the progressive persuasion cannot have a share. This, our disapproval, is a common hatred of oppression, and we share it with the common man everywhere on earth. This is our bipartisan foreign policy. We are committed to fight slavery and hunger, to fight them to the death. Progressives the world over acknowledge the general guilt and mutual failures of all the nations calling themselves free, but the true progressive believes in progress by means of the orderly process of democracy. The reactionaries nowadays preach a kind of nihilism. Progressive nowadays are less radical. We don't consider that the present crisis offers a simple choice between getting tough or getting soft. We are certain that the world will not be changed for the better by another world war. Only the sworn opponents of human life itself believe that. Those who are busy now manufacturing war are those who would bequeath to the conqueror worm the merest spinning globe of empty ash. Progressives are more conservative. We propose to keep this planet open for business, human business. We don't want to give away our atom bomb, but we don't think it's necessary to blow up the Kremlin to keep the secret. No single nation, we think, can be trusted with such a terrible toy. No single nation, including our own. Of course, I have no commission to speak for all progressives. If I take issue with some part of a speech by Henry Wallace, think how much of what I say here will be cause for quarrel with many of you. It's my comfort that the best of what I have to say is none of it new. It's all been hammered into words of steel and gold by statesmen. Americans like Jefferson and Roosevelt and Wilkie and Wallace. Mere orators and journalists like myself have been spelling out those words since the first prophet came down from the first mountain with the news that all of us who are the earth's inhabitants are brothers. But this is a time of crisis for the democratic faith. For this time, there can't be too many citizens, big and little, who are publishing abroad these tidings of joy which shall be to all men, the simple truth that peace is possible without appeasement. If there's been a point of purpose to any of these broadcasts of mine, it's to repeat the obvious assurance, peace is only possible with cooperation. Let the victors of an anti-fascist war continue the anti-fascist fight. Let them make that fight by mutual exertion an all-out fight. And then there won't be time or room left on the globe for the aggressions of empire. Our duty is plain. As citizens of the United Nations, we must see to it that the United Nations fulfill the purposes which brought those nations into partnership. There is injustice in Russia's Georgia and in the United States' Georgia. But we can't fight that injustice by fighting Russia or by fighting our own civil war again. We need a tough policy, not with a district or a state or a great power. We need to get tough with tyranny, every form of it, wherever it flourishes. Too much time is being wasted on hysteria about the threat to peace. Too much time can never be given to the care and nourishment of those things which make peace possible and worth preserving. To protect those things, the United Nations were united. Only the protection of those things can keep the nations united. To fulfill the purposes of that partnership is to outlaw war, to declare war a crime by the courts and councils of a militant peace, and more effectively, to see it outlawed as a probability by the logic of history. Now my time's up. I have one more broadcast. I hope you'll join me then next week at the same time. Thank you for your letters again. Thank you for listening to me when you have. Till next week, I remain as always obediently yours.
This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.